Hi everyone. It's been too long since the last live. Welcome to another episode of the Abdullah Samir podcast. Your friendly neighborhood ex-Muslim. I'm joined today by Tim. Tim and I got acquainted through a common friend on Facebook. And Tim is originally from Seattle, Washington, where he was raised in poverty in the very conservative and extremist independent fundamental Baptist sect of Protestant Christianity. So it turns out that even though Tim is a former Christian and I'm a former Muslim, we actually have a lot in common. Who would have known? So we're gonna go through the whole story. How's it going, Tim?
Oh, it's going well. It's finally stopped raining outside, so that's good. It's nice now.
It's actually raining over here too.
Yeah.
Coincidence.
It was, but it's all sunny now, so we're good.
Awesome. So let's just get started with a little bit of a background. I said basically what your background is, but could you like elaborate a bit, tell us a little bit more about what it's like to grow up in this fundamentalist sect that you grew up in?
Sure. I'll start a little bit before me. My mother was actually raised in more of a mainstream, I guess you could say, religious context. She was raised as an Episcopalian in Britain, some other places I've known as more as like an Anglican, you know, pretty mainstream Christianity. Nothing out of the ordinary, really. But when she was 18, she met my dad and they took off to Seattle. She's originally from the Midwest. It was there that they had these door knockers come and knock on our door. And she was going through, you know, sort of a difficult marriage and that kind of thing. So I think she was very open and receptive to it. She was already kind of religious. They have door knockers, you know, what they call soul winners, actually, who try to go door to door to convert people, sort of what a lot of people in the U.S. or the West in general associate more with, say, Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses. But they do the same thing. So it was there that she sort of converted into the IFB, or Independent Fundamental Baptist sort of religion. Their beliefs, some of them are very similar to a lot of mainstream Christian beliefs, but they take it a step further. They're Bible literalists. So they believe, you know, the only authority is, you know, the Word of God. They even, almost all of them, follow or believe in only reading the King James Version, the 1611 text of the Bible. They think that the other translations have been tampered with by man or something to that effect.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
and I guess the young earth creation, if the Bible literalists, also young earth creationists, they believe
the earth was... Yeah,
is 6,000 years or something like that?
They think that the Earth is anywhere from I think 6 to 10,000 years old. That yes, God created the world in a literal 6 days and rested on the seventh. That man coexisted with dinosaurs. They believe that. I even met someone before in the church who believed that the dinosaurs were put there by Satan to confuse Christians. So the bones, the fossils, I mean, so that's kind of funny to me now. So they are very much biblical literalists, politically very conservative and right wing. It's not often that sects of a religion will call themselves fundamentalists, but they do. So
they actually call themselves fundamentalists.
They do. And they're very proud of the moniker. They're very proud of being fundamentalists, because they believe that, you know, you go to the fundamentals of the Bible and what it teaches, that it says, they have a saying, it's kind of cringe, but they say, you know, God said it, I read it. That settles it, or something like that. So yeah, they believe in the, you know, literal everything that's written in the King James Version of the Bible. So yeah, I'm not sure why early modern English is better than, you know, the 21st century English.
But, yeah. Do you know why they pick on the King James? The King James edition, it's a human effort, right? Like it's It's an effort by a human being to try to translate the Bible into at least as authentic as an experience as anyone else is trying to do. Mm-hmm. Why do they? You know, why they pick on that? Why they focus on King James specifically?
Yeah, they have. It's funny to me actually. I've talked to my mother about this, who's still very much IFB. She thinks that the KJV is the only one. And we were taught about it when I was growing up. I can't tell you the details, but there's some. They believe that like the NIV, the New International Version, for example, or the New Standard Revised Version, or you know all these other versions, English translations of the Bible that exist. There's quite a few of them. That they were translated from the wrong text, the wrong original text. So they go off of the King James Version was translated in 1611 from a text, I believe, called the Textus Receptus. And they believe that that's the only one that was really did preserve Word of God. And also that King James, who was the King of England, who authorized it all. It's also, that's why it's also known as the Authorized Version. That he was led by God to preserve, you know, God's word in the English language. So it's kind of interesting.
Kings are representatives of God on earth, right? That was the belief back then.
It was. I don't think it necessarily means that they're all monarchists. They're not. But they it's ironic to me actually because King James was a Catholic, so he was definitely not an independent fundamental Baptist and not share the same views. But they believe that you know God used him to preserve the Word of God in the English language. So yeah, and that the other ones have differences. There's a lot of different verses where they use, where they say, see, the wording is different here, and that, you know, takes away the blood of Christ for this or that or whatever, where they, you know, use that kind of reasoning to say that the other translations of the Bible are tainted by human intervention to take away from the gospel and God's word. So, yeah, it's kind of nuts when you think about it and say it out loud.
Yeah. It's interesting, yeah. It reminds me of... you don't see this in the Muslim community as much. Like, mm-hmm. you don't see that Muslims say, "Oh, I only use this translation." Mm. Majority of Muslims don't speak Arabic in the world. I would think the majority can read Arabic because you're taught it just the sounds, just reading the sounds of the Arabic language. So, Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Like, you know how to read it. You can see the letters and you can join. Me personally, I grew up in a different sect. So I didn't learn that reading the Quran wasn't important to my father or to anyone in that sect, to be honest. So I was reading in English. I wasn't even reading in Arabic. I taught myself how to read the Arabic letters.
Wow.
But in terms of the translations, there's not really, people don't really, I mean, you always hear from Muslims that, oh, this guy's translation's long. But nobody really, everyone has their own sort of preferences, but there's no like sect that's, except for like the Ahmadis. Ahmadis, they have their own translation because, and then of course, in their translation, they reinterpret the way Jesus dies so that he's not crucified, right? Because they don't believe he was crucified. They believe he died in India. So the interpretation is different. And same thing with the Submitters sect, which is a very tiny sect of Quranists. They don't accept Hadith, any sayings of Muhammad. I mean, they don't accept that. They say Quran is enough. So their translation is a little bit wonky too. So I there are sects, I guess, that do have their own translations, mm-hmm. but like mainstream Muslims don't refer to those translations.
Right. I think it is similar in a certain sense to, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in Islam for example, I used to be in the military, and when I was in boot camp, there was a guy in my boot camp division who was from Pakistan, and originally, and he, of course, was a Muslim, not surprisingly, from Pakistan, but he, we talked about Islam and that kind of thing, and I said, well, you know, you speak, you know, Urdu, being from Pakistan. I said, yeah, and I said, well, but your Quran, and you're showing it to me, is in Arabic. I was like, can you speak Arabic? You know, and he said, not really. but he said, I can read it. And I said, oh, so you can kind of just say the sounds you understand. So he's like, well, I'm hit or miss on understanding, but I can read it like phonetically at the very least.
Yeah.
I've studied it, you know, in the translations, you know, so I know what it says.
Yeah.
So that's something interesting to me because as far as I know, Islam believes that the Quran is only really a Quran if it's in Arabic.
Yeah.
I mean, you can correct me.
The
English translation of the Quran is like, well, it's just a translation of it. It's explaining it in another language, but it's not.
Yes. Quran. Yes, 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 exactly. Muslim scholars and Muslims believe that the Quran is only Quran in the Arabic, and then the actual English translation are just interpretations. I was confused about this a bit when I was Muslim because people would say, I ended up Salafi / Wahhabi. So the Saudi hardline sort of literalist leaning interpretation, that sect. Mm-hmm. And the mosque I used to go to, one of the things they would talk about is, and sometimes you'd even hear lay Muslims say this. Mm-hmm. They would say things like, it's kind of funny, actually. They would say, when you read the Quran translation, don't read the stuff in brackets because that's an interpretation from the translator. But the whole thing is an interpretation. Right. Just
that's what translation is. Right? That's what translation is.
You can't understand it at all without interpreting it to some extent. I mean, you can try to be as close to the original as possible, but mm-hmm. however you do it, you're going to be putting your own voice. I mean, you can try not to, but
sure.
And even when you're reading the Arabic Quran, I mean, you're going based on the meanings that those symbols have to you today, unless you go back to like ancient Arabic mm-hmm. and you say, well, 7th century Arabic, you know, this word meant that. And that's a lot harder. Like I had an Egyptian friend. Egyptians speak Arabic, but it's like Amalay. It doesn't even sound like Arabic. It's totally it's totally different. Like the vocabulary has changed so much, right? Like nobody says the word jisr for bridge. Just nobody says that. If you say that, they'll laugh at you.
Right. Well, I mean, language changes. This is, you know, something that's really interesting to me about, you know, the Abrahamic religions, because, you know, even within Judaism, you know, they still, you know, Jews around the world, you know, will read in Hebrew at their bar mitzvah, et cetera, where, you know, the original language is preserved in a sense. But even if you take like the KJV, you know, King James Version of the Bible, no one talks like they write in the KJV anymore. That was, you know, Shakespearean English. It's not just the words that have changed, they have, but it's also even the grammar of English has changed since then. So for example, saying it repenteth him, which means like he regretted it. We don't talk like that.
Is that how the King James one is?
Yeah, it's early modern English. It's early modern English. It was written in or translated in 1611. So this is basically Shakespearean English.
That must be hard to understand.
English, though, it can be. Yeah. I think because I think I was raised with it, so I'm used to it. In fact, we'll get, I think, more into that in a little bit. But I was actually taught to read with the KJV. So I'm very familiar with it. I'm used to it. But I think most people, you know, would like kind of further browse at some of the sort of grammar and, you know, vocabulary of the King James Version of the Bible. You know, just like if they're reading, you know, Shakespeare, they're going, wait, what does that mean?
Yeah. And I remember the original Yusuf Ali I had, who had a lot of thous and dast and
that. Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, it has like, you know, these and thous. It's known for being that, you know, like that. I mean, for example, you know, English used to have, you know, like a different theme, you, which is like third person plural or second person plural, whatever. And thou and all this and registers of speech. And English has changed since then. Nobody uses that anymore. it's simplified and we just say you now instead of, you know, thee and thou and stuff like that. So thee, for example, is like the way you say I as a subject and, you know, me as an object, you know, you as a, you know, and then thee as, you know, the object. So it just, we don't talk like that anymore. And it's just, it seems really weird to try to, I guess, you know, like insist that everybody sort of learn early modern English
yeah.
and how to read it. I think a lot of it you can maybe understand, but there's also some parts and some words, and it can confuse people, I think, because like I said, it's not just the vocabulary that's changed. It's the grammar has literally changed quite a lot, 400 years. So,
yeah. And that's, I think, it's always a challenge with these so-called books that claim to be from God, inspired by God, or in the case of the Quran, literally the word of God, like as literal as you can get, which, you know, that claim is going under some challenges now in the public eye because of all of, there's been a lot of drama around the narrative that the Quran is preserved. But anyways, regardless of whether it's preserved or not, the fact is it's almost impossible to get the exact meaning that was there at the time without like heavily studying it. My Egyptian friend couldn't read the Quran in Arabic, even though he spoke Arabic to his parents. Right. He wasn't like great at it, but reading the Quran, there's a lot of things in the Quran. I don't know what that word is. And that word doesn't, like, that sentence is not like, it sounds like I don't totally get what it's saying. And on top of it with the Quran, you have another layer, which is without knowing the story of the Prophet's life, you just don't know what it's talking about. You have no idea when God says he sent you angels and we made you rest. Like, what is it talking about? If you don't know the story of the battle of Badr, the first battle, then you're like, okay, made them sleep. What? And they had dreams. And I'm like, what's going on here? You have no clue. That's another challenge with the Quran. With the Bible, does the Bible have that same challenge too? Is it like sort of self-encapsulating?
Well, no. There's a lot of disagreement within Christian sects on what different parts of the Bible mean. An example of this would be there are some churches that are called like Pentecostal or the Charismatic Movement. I mean, the Charismatic Movement exists in different sects, but it's most well known in like Pentecostalists. There's a verse in Acts, I don't remember exactly, but there's a verse in Acts where, the book of Acts, where they had the day of Pentecost and they had something called speaking in tongues.
Mm-hmm.
The way I was raised, we believe that to mean, in the context of the story that's being told, that there was a multinational group and that God miraculously translated the words of the preacher so that everyone could understand.
Google Translate, back in the
would be pretty impressive, if it was true. But the Pentecostals, the Charismatics, believe that they do something called speaking in tongues, which is mentioned, but they in that early modern English, it just means tongue was synonymous with language, right? His tongue, his native tongue, etc. We don't say that as much anymore, but. But anyway, there's a disagreement there because they in church, when they feel the Holy Spirit, they start babbling.
I've seen that.
I don't know if you've seen it before. Watch a great documentary called Jesus Camp.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the kids are putting their hands up and, you know, kind of stuff.
We did
that. We thought that was insane. So we thought that was doing that. Nothing to do. But again, this is based on a different interpretation of the Bible. It's, you know. There's all kinds of arguments over what this verse means or that verse means. For example, is salvation through grace and, you know, a belief and works, or is it faith alone and that kind of thing? So, all these theological discussions, because a lot of it isn't very clear, and it really depends on your decided interpretation of it.
I was going to talk about that just before we move on. I want to talk about that speaking tongues thing a bit. It's interesting because it does sound like nonsense, like abla, like it's just sounds coming out of your mouth,
right?
It's interesting that there's a parallel to that in the Islamic tradition, sort of, but in a different way. Just listen. So in the Islamic tradition, there's exorcisms, and during exorcism, people start babbling as well. And I've heard, like, Muslims, I thought it was funny. Muslims told me that they have seen, like, I had one Muslim friend, used to be my friend, told me that you should come and watch this because the guy started speaking Chinese and he doesn't know Chinese. And I'm like, come on, give me a break. Okay. Maybe he heard some Chinese words when he was young and he's repeating them. Yeah. And he's like, no, he's speaking Chinese. Okay. I said, what did he say in Chinese? He's like, I don't know. I'm like, did you record it? No. Okay, so next time, record it. Let's let's get it to somebody. Let's check it.
Right.
is it actually Chinese? It just sounds like Chinese. Well, whatever the language it was. And like, let's find out, like, is it really possible? Because they're claiming the devil came inside him and was making him speak. And that's not tongues, but it's making him speak in a different language that an actual, like, actually communicating. Well, of course, you know, from my perspective, I'm like, come on. It's just making sounds.
It's just gibberish. I mean, if you watch it, I mean, it's, they're not saying anything in it. It does beg the question of that kind of thing. I wasn't raised with that kind of thing, but I knew of it because they preached against it in my church and said it was nonsense. And they were right about that. it's easy. They can always see everyone else's nonsense, but not their own. Just babble. And I never did understand, like, the point of that. I mean, if God can hear you when you're speaking English or, I don't know, Burmese, then what's the point in babbling in some kind of celestial language? It made no sense to me anyway. But kind of when you're possessed by the Holy Spirit or God or something, it exists in different, you know, religious traditions, I guess. Yeah.
I was just going to leave this comment. It's a good comment. God didn't expect such drastic change in language. Well, that goes back to the main flaw of sending a book at a specific time. If God really did that, I mean, that just doesn't make a lot of sense, because it's going to be out of date pretty soon. I mean, either you send a continuous message of some sort, or you just leave very general guidance. Be good to people, don't cheat, don't steal, you know, like, you know, general.
Don't be a jerk.
Don't be a dick, basically, right?
One page, just don't be a jerk.
and we see some of that in Buddhism. If you look at the seven noble truths or whatever, like, there's some of those universal principles of being good, don't harm others, and I don't even know them, but you know what I mean? That doesn't come from God.
Well, that's what's interesting. I think there's some things that are very unique to sort of the monotheistic Abrahamic religions that don't exist in other religions, including, like, religious exclusivity. You know, in Buddhism, it's often syncretic. If you look at different countries, like in Japan, you know, most people are essentially both Buddhist and Shinto at the same time, even if it's not supposed to be that way theologically, because they just don't care. And they're not, they're also, Japan, for example, where I lived for a long time, they're also just not religious people. Even if they, you know, say, go to the shrine on New Year's, like they're, you know, supposed to, and stuff like that. If you say, like, are you religious? Most of them will say no. And just be like, what's your religion? I don't really have one. But didn't you go to the temple? Well, yeah, I guess. You know, like, it's just like a cultural tradition more than anything for most Japanese people. And it's just interesting that, you know, a lot of the Abrahamic religions and sects, like, require such this huge, what's the word I'm looking for, like, devotion, you know, and, like, all of yourself into this religion. There's much less half-assing it, if you will. it must be, you know, really all-encompassing in your life for it to be, you know, real, genuine religion. And that's something that I find kind of fascinating, the similar between, you know, sects of Islam and, you know, sort of sects of Christianity.
Yeah, every sect thinks that they're the right sect and they're the only one. Well, I think most of them are exclusivist as well. Most of the sects claim to be the only one that's going to heaven, I guess. I mean, I don't know for sure if, like, I know there's some disagreement among sects whether, like, all, like, you know, some Sunnis will say, some will say Shias will go to heaven, maybe. Or they'll say things like conditionally depends on what they believe and this and that. But of course, they don't think that the correct sect. There is a Sunni hadith that says that all of the sects are going to hell except for the saved sect, which is my sect, which is the sect, the my sect meaning Muhammad's sect. A lot of these hadiths were probably made up after the fact. To sort of, you know, justify different theological positions or to justify, you know, a lot of other things as well. So, so going back to your story, what happened next after that?
So, she got into this church, she went to church in the Seattle area. I first went to church, like, right after I was born. So I went to church three times a week for 17 years of my life. And that's usually Sunday morning service, Sunday evening service, and then a midweek service. Like usually a Wednesday night or something like that, or a Thursday night where you have a sort of, it's a service, but it's also not as preachy. It's more of like a little bit more towards like deeper study of the Bible kind of thing, taught by the pastor. And so my life was shaped, you know, with that worldview, with that life. And the beliefs are very, for like salvation, it's easy. You say, you know, the sinner's prayer, right? You accept Jesus into your heart kind of thing. Baptism isn't necessary for salvation, but it's supposed to show the world that you're now a born again Christian kind of thing, which is not so strange in, you know, other sects of, you know, Protestant Christianity. They also believe that they question people's salvation if they are living a worldly life. So they believe in separatism from the world, in the world, but not of the world, as they say. So they believe to be completely separate from the world. Most of them do not put their children in secular or public schools. They either homeschool them or put them in, you know, like fundamentalist run, church run schools. For example, one curriculum they used, and I used partially as a kid, we didn't use it a lot because we didn't have the money for it, but it was called ACE, and you can look it up. And they, you know, teach kids about, you know, the reading and writing and stuff like that. But it also, they're like books you work through yourself, and then, you know, you have teachers who basically just allow the kids to work through the books and learn on their own like that. It's kind of strange. Of course, in the science section, the world is only 6,000 years old, and it's inundated with Bible verses you have to memorize and that kind of thing. It's wow. A very weird education system. But that's just one example of it. There's other curriculums that people use, like Abeka books and stuff like that, that are also feminist. However, I was raised in a really impoverished family. I grew up in really abject poverty, kind that people that exist in the US, it does. So living in houses that probably weren't fit for human habitation, often without heat or, you know, air conditioning or anything like that. Really impoverished, a lot of hunger and relying on the state and stuff like that. So we didn't have money for books. Or proper, curriculum. There are families who do homeschooling well, who, you know, have a set schedule and, you know, they actually teach their kids. My mom did not do that. And then she eventually just said, oh, well, I'm unschooling them, which is this idea that you teach kids the very basics and then they learn what they want to learn and they can expand their minds. I had to grow up in this, you know, very fundamentalist kind of family, very authoritarian. The pastors were scary, they, you know, if they even suspected that you were making eyes at a girl or something like that, I mean, you could get in front of the whole church, you know what I mean? It's very intimidating, it's very, you know, controlled, you have to dress right, you have to cut your hair, you have to, say all the right things, do all the right things. Very strict dress code for men and women, especially for women, of course. How I actually ended up getting an education is because I went out and did odd jobs like mowing lawns and doing yard work and stuff like that for a little bit of money here and there, you know, just in the neighborhood kind of thing. Saved up money and bought books on my own and started reading and going to the library on my own and started learning and reading. Which sort of led me to kind of secretly start really questioning everything I'd been taught as a teenager, when I was a teenager. And so by the time I moved out of the house when I was 17, I never went back. I never went back to this.
Sounds like it was a tough childhood. I mean, growing up in poverty, having not being able to go to school. So your parents, I guess your mom in particular, didn't want to put you in school because she thought the school was satanic or something, or had some bad values, or what was the main motivation behind keeping you out of school, teaching you science or something?
So kind of like that thing. She believed that she called them government schools, that they taught, you know, liberal values like accepting LGBT people, oh no, yeah. Or just liberal values about government and society and social issues. And she also believed that, you know, God said that parents should teach their kids, not really delegate it to someone else. So even though she didn't really teach us, but
that's very strange.
It is very strange.
You have to do everything yourself. You have to teach her kids. You can't hire anybody.
Well, it goes back to their social ideas of the family, and which is why I come from a very large family, They, of course, they don't believe in things like contraception or birth control, even prophylactics. You know, they believe that you should have as many kids as possible because that's the blessings from God. And God said, "Be fruitful and multiply." And so, multiply they do. I have a total of 10 sisters and 3 brothers.
Wow.
Yeah. 7 of us are full siblings. My mother did divorce when I was like 5, but 7 of us were from the same parents. But my mom, she gave birth to 11 children. Yeah. And we're not the only family I know of that. I mean, I knew of at least a couple or 3 different families that had, you know, that many kids or more. Even by the same parents without, divorce and remarry kind of thing. A lot of families in that religion, if they don't have as many as like 10 or 12 or 13 or something like that, will have, you know, average like 6 kids or something like that, or, you know, 5 kids, 7 kids, something like that. It's very common to have quite large families.
Yeah.
And it's a very big thing. It's called the Quiverful Movement that you can look it up, anybody who's watching, if you want to know what that's all about. But yeah, they basically believe that, you know, kids are a blessing from God and you're supposed to have as many as possible. So they do, yeah.
Wow, that's something else. I mean, Islam has the same idea of, you know, Muhammad said, "I want to be proud of your numbers on the Day of Judgment. I want to have the biggest ummah." So the hadith encourages Muslims to, go forth and multiply without using those words. The difference is nowadays most Muslims do accept contraception.
Right.
There's no real ban on that, I guess. I mean, some Muslims think it's haram, but the minority for sure.
Yeah.
Most Muslims consider that it's okay to use temporary measures, not permanent measures. So vasectomy is not allowed. You're not allowed to permanently stop having kids. But you're allowed to use like condoms or something like that. Anything that, you know, IUD or something like that. Most Muslims don't have a problem with that. But they still usually, you'd find the very religious Muslims do have really big families. They just keep having kids. I mean, I have friends that have, even today, like 5. I mean, I have 5. But I mean, I know some that have 6 and even 7 kids. Not as common nowadays, though.
Yeah. And you'd think, especially with the polygamy that exists in a lot of Muslim cultures, that there's potential for really big families. I mean, you can imagine that would, if that got out of hand, you'd have a brood of like 100 or something. So, exaggerating a little bit, but yeah. Obviously. I can see how that get out of hand if you have 4 wives. A little bit something different in the in most Christian sects. Yeah, polygamy isn't a thing. So,
polygamy is what? Is not allowed, you said?
No, it's not. Because in my church, they believe in, you know, God said, there's like a verse that says, like, describes marriage as a woman shall leave her father and mother, or a man shall leave his father and his mother and cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. So they take that as the meaning that marriage is between one man and one woman.
I don't know very many Muslims who have 2 wives or more in Canada. I know one imam did.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually had, so the way he did it was he had 2 households. So they don't live in the same house. He actually had 2 houses.
Oh, wow.
And I know, like, it's like, wow, how did you get the money for that? He actually did real estate. I don't think he made money from being an imam because he was more into like spending money on the mosque. So I don't think he made money off that because running the mosque was more expensive than like the income, the donations or whatever, at least that one small mosque I used to go to. But I found out from a friend that he had two wives. And then he actually mentioned it once in one of the khutbas. He said, yeah, I have two wives. And you know, bigamy is illegal in Canada.
Yeah, so it's illegal here too.
Yeah, you're not allowed to have two wives. But he said officially one of them is his mistress or girlfriend. So he's not breaking any laws. But technically, they're both his wives under Islamic law. He had a nikah. With both of them. Yeah, on paper, one of them is not a wife. But the interesting thing is he was talking about how because he has kids at both residences, they're both considered his home, and he can, as a real estate agent, he can sell both of them and not pay capital gains. So he was actually getting tax benefit from having two families. They're taking advantage of the system. I mean, it happens, right?
There's a little scam going on there. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I mean, I've heard of cases in the UK of Muslim men having multiple wives, and then they get government benefits for each one of the wives, and they keep it for themselves and stuff like that. I mean, I've heard of that. In Canada, it's like I said, it's very, the Canadian Muslim community is very different from the British Muslim community. Mm-hmm. Like I said, that's the one example I can think of someone that has two wives. Mm-hmm. I know a couple of men, a couple of guys. I know one guy told me he wanted to get a second wife, but I don't know anyone who actually did it, except for that one imam, and he's an imam, so of course he's a little bit different. Maybe they do and they don't talk about it. I mean, I've heard like whispers, you know, this guy said, I know this person, this poor lady, that she, you know, the man basically. I think what's more common with the polygamy thing is Muslim men that don't divorce their second wife, and they don't divorce their wife, they don't tell her, and they just go and get married again. It's kind of like a mistress. She's more like a mistress, but she's a second wife. She's actually a second wife, but the first wife doesn't know about it. So it's basically cheating, right? But according to Islam, you don't, again, it's a matter of scholarly interpretation, but I've read that you don't have to tell your wife.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, obviously that's not ideal, but if you do that, there's no sin on you for having multiple wives. And of course it's incredibly unethical, and you know, it definitely, it causes problems for sure, because usually what happens is the first wife, when she finds out, she's going to be devastated. And this guy has two families now, he's running, and it takes away resources from the main family. It creates a mess in general. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's obviously not ideal. And, but yeah, some men do it, so it's happens.
It's not a good idea, but yeah. You asked me about like sort of the growing up and stuff too, and like I wanted to touch on like the hair and dress, because I think this is something that is similar in a lot of sects of Islam, like the idea of modesty, you know, especially for women, but also for men to a certain extent. In the church I grew up in. Like my hair now would be way too long, not allowed. It's not even that long, but it's definitely touched my shoulders. They believe it should be, you know, cut, so that it's not long at all, that it doesn't hang, or, you know, anything, that it's above the ears, you know.
So I have a question about that. Where are they getting this from? Is this just traditional gender roles according to the society that we live in, and so we want to maintain that, or is that actually something in the Bible that you shouldn't have long hair, or only women should have long hair, or women can't have short hair?
Yeah, well, there's a Bible verse. Hold on, I can kind of see it. It's like see this one, because there's a Bible verse that mentions this. It says, doth not, nature, well, I don't have to look it up, it's all right. But it said basically that doth not nature even tell you that, you know, that that is a shame unto a man to have long hair. So there's a Bible verse that mentions that says it's a shame.
Are you serious?
Yeah, there's a Bible verse that says that. I'd have to look it up.
That's funny. I want to share a little story about that, because you just reminded me something. One of my sons used to have long hair, like just like yours. And there was this one uncle in the community, like, and I say uncle, I don't mean literal uncle, but he was like a older gentleman in the Muslim community. Actually, he was a family relative, let's say. And every time he would see my son, Adam, he'd be like, you can't have long hair. And I was like getting so annoyed, because I'm like, where are you getting this from? He's like, no, it's not, because this is Pakistani uncle, sorry, Indian uncle. In his culture, it's considered like men have to have short hair, women have to have long hair. There's nothing in the Quran that says, or Hadith, that says you can't have long hair. But apparently the way he interpreted it as strict gender roles, in Islam, you're not allowed to imitate women. So like a lot of, like, I was told I can't wear a necklace. Men can't wear necklaces. And then when I took a class with Yasukadi, Yasukadi said, or having an earring, he said, because this is kind of weird, right? What about cultures where men wear earrings? Like the actual culture, it's considered manly to wear an earring. He's like, yeah, in that culture, it'd be okay to wear an earring. But in our culture, if it's considered feminine, you can't wear earrings. So according to Islam, this is Islam. Islam says, according to the gender roles of your society, you can't, like, it doesn't even make sense. It's not objective. It's so subjective.
Yeah, of course. And that's something that always bothered me as well when I was growing up in this, because, for example, women are not allowed to wear, you know, pants, trousers. They must wear, you know, a dress or a skirt. It has to be flowing garment, because of Bible verses that say, you know, men and women shouldn't wear each other's clothes, so to speak. You know what I mean? Like, men should wear men's clothes, women should wear women's clothes. And that never made sense to me, because I'm like, well, what about the Scots and kilts? I mean, those are essentially skirts. They are. I don't know how a kilt would be seen as anything other than a type of skirt that's worn by men. In fact, a lot of cultures around the world, men wear flowing garments. I mean, look at Japan, you know, wearing kimono, right? Men wear kimono. They wear, you know, these long flowing, you know, hakama and stuff like that. So, like, and that's not feminine. Like, they don't wear the, you know, men don't wear, you know, the women's one usually. It's a different style and stuff, but they're both flowing garments. So it seems really arbitrary, you know, to say that, you know.
And even the Arabs wear what looks like a dress. It's a long, the thobe.
Right,
it's like
right.
One piece of cloth that goes, and even the men, they wear like a Pakistan, sorry, not the men, like in Indian cultures, like Bangladesh and Pakistan, there's this thing that's like a shawl that you wrap around your waist, like a, it's like a dress, basically. My dad used to wear one. In Kenya, we call the lungi. It's pretty much like a dress. Like if you look at it.
Well, I mean, it's in so many cultures. I have family from Cambodia, and like my stepmom and sister and all that. And they, like men there also wear a type of like, well, it looks like a sari. I forget the exact word for it, but it's similar to that. So, I mean, it's in many cultures, and like to say that, like, say a man shouldn't wear something more. But if you ask them, like, you know, like, well, what about kilts? Then they would say, oh, well, that's different. it doesn't make any sense. It's like, well, how about you just not care what people wear? Your opinions yourself kind of thing. But it doesn't really hurt you, does it?
You know, one of my concerns with this whole thing is that when, I don't know if you can tell me whether this applies to Christianity, I'll tell you how it applies in Islam. When Islam comes, okay, I'll tell you, I'll give you a good example. So you have these Dawah guys, in particular, Hamza Soetis and Aira, they're going to Africa and New Guinea, and they're going to these tribes which were naked. They're pretty much naked, not totally naked, but like pretty much naked. And they're preaching Islam to them. And if these guys accept Islam, and you know, they have their painted faces and all that, Islam comes and it just comes and starts knocking down parts of the culture. It'll be like, oh, you can't go around naked anymore. That's considered immoral. Oh, women have to cover their hair now, you know. Oh, you can't you know, do this and do that. And these cultures, I'm not saying everything in the culture is good, but like a lot of these things. Like, let's just say they culturally evolved for a reason. I don't know why they don't wear clothes. I don't really don't care. But they're not like going around like sexually harassing. Yeah, I guess that was one obvious reason. But they're not like sexually harassing each other just because the women are not covered or something. Like it's considered normal. Like just walk around like that. It's over here. It's like, oh my God, you know, you have to dress a certain way. And of course, every culture is different. But, you know, Islam comes in and then it just goes and creates all these arbitrary nonsense. Okay, all the meat has to be halal now. So let's say, for example, they live in a place where there's a lot of pigs, a lot of boar. They can't eat any of those now. Why? Because it's haram, because the 7th century man who got it from the Jewish religion said that pig is haram, swine is haram. So they can't do that anymore. So that creates problems for the local people because hell, like that's what they're surviving on. And maybe they eat lard. Maybe they use a pig skin. The pig skin is haram in Islam. You can't wear pig skin. You can't wear shoes made or clothes out of leather, pig leather, because it's najis. It's filth. It's considered filth.
Not allowed to play like American football. They would throw the old pig skin around.
Yeah, I think that would be problematic too. I don't know if it's like something you're touching compared to wearing is different than like, say, like you're holding it. Like you can hold a pig. I mean, that's not considered. I don't think you can. That's not a problem. I mean, like wearing it, I think would be problematic.
Wearing it is a problem, yeah.
And I'm even wrong on that, but that's the way I understand it. I think it's
probably depends on the sect as well. Some people might have more, you know, strict, you know, like rules, definition.
Yeah, I mean, in general, no pig nothing pig would be. Pig is kind of a strong prohibition in Islam, so you wouldn't find probably anyone wearing pig skin of any sort. But that's what I'm saying. It goes and destroys and messes up. Is that a problem in Christianity too, where they come in Africa and they convert these people, and then now they're suddenly Christian? And I'm sure. Before you answer, one more thing. I'm sure there's some positives that come out of them converting to Islam. I'm sure that there might be some, you know, maybe they. I mean, I'm sure they will probably give up some things that are bad for society, like some vices. Let's say, like, maybe alcohol is a problem in a society. Sure. Maybe they will, you know, that'll solve that problem. I'm not saying it's completely bad, but I still don't agree with it. But anyways, so you can go ahead.
No, that's right. Yeah, no, there definitely is. I mean, in the church I was raised in, there's definitely a huge focus on missionary work and evangelism, you know, winning the lost, as they call them, winning the lost. Everyone's out there is just lost in life and don't know it. And so they send, like, I remember when I was a kid, every so often in our church, we'd have visiting missionaries come, who they, you know, do fundraising kind of, you know, circuits around, you know, the country, to different, you know, fundamentalist churches, to raise, you know, support them in the field when they go to, you know, everywhere from Australia and the UK to Ghana or Papua New Guinea. So, like, they, and, you know, they believe, you know, like, the Great Commission, you know, God to go forth and spread the gospel, basically. But to all nations, you know, every creature and all this. The missionaries, I think Christianity, whether it's, you know, the sect I was raised in or other, even, evangelical Protestant sects or Catholicism, definitely does attack the mores of and the sort of way of life of any, you know, because if they convert, that's not just saying, okay, I'm a Christian now. You have to walk the walk, so to speak. And that means would be covering yourself up. And, you know, for example, if you're a woman in, I don't know, Papua New Guinea or something, or Vanuatu, you'd have to definitely cover yourself up. You have to start, you know, abiding by, you know, the morals that the religion teaches, in a sense. So yeah, this exists in a huge way. And I think that it has definitely negatively affected a lot of countries. Like in Africa, for example, there's been, you know, along with colonialism in Africa, of course, came a lot of missionaries. Mostly from, like, you know, mainstream and conservative Protestant sects. And now you're seeing problems, for example, like in countries like, I think, Uganda or something like that. I can't remember exactly what off the top of my head. But I think it was like in Uganda, for example, or somebody can correct me, but they've had huge problems with wanting to make homosexuality a crime punishable by death because of this, you know, conservative Christian, you know, influence in these countries. Although that's quite a minority position, I think, in most of the Christian world to say kill gay people. It definitely is one teaching that gays are wrong, you know, being gay is wrong, you know, is something that really sunk in there. And that they have, you know, more of just, you know, homophobia, stay away from gay people, to, you know, we have to root them out of our society. We have to literally kill them. We should be executing them for that. So that's just one example.
Which is actually a big problem in Islam, because Islam, you have much more support for killing gay people than you would in Christianity. Of course, it's reducing over time, but the classical scholarly opinion on gays is they should be thrown off buildings and or stoned to death or something like this. This is pretty harsh, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I mean, originally in the Bible, it says if most interpret this verse this way, where it says if a man lieth with another man as with a woman, then he shall be put to death.
Do the Jews still follow that law by any chance? Do they believe in that?
For example, if you go to Israel, I don't think, you can be gay by law in Israel, you can be free to be gay. But however, do certain sects of, I think, conservative Judaism are still hugely opposed to it? I mean, just listen to people like Ben Shapiro. he might not say it out loud, but he's very much against, you know, gay people, is very homophobic. So so I think that does exist. I mean, that part of the Bible actually came from, you know, like the Torah, or, you know, the old, you know, Hebrew text. So It definitely was a thing in Judaism before, especially, although I don't think most Jewish people today don't abide by that, but originally, they believed in that homosexuality, especially male homosexuality, because it doesn't say much about female homosexuality, weirdly, but it says, you know, that they should be put to death. So,
That's a funny thing in Islam too, but it's not really, lesbianism is not really mentioned even in the Quran, because the people of Lot were men, right? And so the story is really talking about men.
Right.
And so what about women? It's a totally different, somehow it's include, because even with women, there's no like penetration, like, so to speak.
Right.
Body parts, so if you know what I mean. So like this, I mean, that's the problem in Islam. It's the actual act. Mm-hmm. So with women, it's not, but it's somehow, you know, it's just included in the, for women as well. And I was gonna say one thing that Muslims tend to get wrong about Christianity is they tend to look at the Old Testament and then they say, aha, see, Christianity is just like Islam, but they don't realize that Christians they don't follow those laws from the Old Testament anymore.
Right, and that's something that's really interesting, that I think if you weren't raised in Christianity, that might be very something that you don't think about, because like the Old Testament and like the Abrahamic laws of like, say, Deuteronomy, these are seen as old rules for pre-Jesus times, and they believe that Jesus created a new covenant. But it's interesting because there's the New Testament says absolutely nothing about, as far as I know, it says nothing about being gay. And that's only in the Old Testament, but they still keep on to that one. But they don't follow the prohibition against wearing clothes of mixed fibers, or the prohibition against eating pork or eating shellfish. It seems sort of very convenient for conservative Christians to, you know, use that one, cherry pick that one, you know what I mean? But they don't follow the rest of the rules of the Old Testament, just that one, you know what I mean? So it's just an excuse for their, you know.
The one they pick is the one about homosexuality?
Right, exactly. So like, pick that one, but they don't follow any of the other ones. I'm not sure why they're focusing on that one rule that says you have to, it also says that if you commit adultery, you should be put to death.
Yeah.
And I don't see anyone, you know, clamoring for that in the Christian churches, on account of protecting the guilty. But so it's kind of interesting that they never talk about like being put to death for, say, adultery, but if you talk to people where I grew up, like, they won't usually say it outright, and they'll kind of like, you know, kind of mumble something, but they do believe still that gay people should be put to death. If you really pushed, you'd get the answer.
Oh, didn't you have a story about that?
Yeah,
your pastor.
Yeah, so for example, one church when I was, we moved around a lot as a kid, I lived in the Midwest when I was a teenager. We went to this one church and the pastor was this very large, intimidating Cajun guy. He was like 6'4", like 300 pounds, he's massive. And he was mean and very much a bully. And he would give, these fire and brimstone kind of, sermons all the time. I saw him before make a comment about, he said he was preaching against homosexuality and, you know, the queer culture and stuff like that. And he mimed shooting a rifle as he said, you know how you wink at a queer, sorry for the language, but, and then he mimed aiming down the barrel of a rifle. So yeah, they literally believe that being homosexual is such a sin. I talked to my brother about it, who's still kind of in the religion, and he said, and I was having a sort of discussion with him once about it, and I was like, well, you know, don't you think that's harm? You know, let people live the way they want to. You can live the way you want to, you know, live and let live kind of thing. And he said, well, he brought up the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, and he said, God hates this so much, he destroyed a city for it. So that shows that it's important to God, and it should be important to us as well. So it's
unfortunate because a lot of these people, they don't realize that if the same, you know, thinking was applied to them, like imagine saying someone should die just because they belong to a particular religious group, mm-hmm. or they, you know, or they belong, and nobody would agree with that. But somehow they think that because someone is gay that they can actually think like that. Right? I mean, it's unfortunate, but I do think that, you know, the Christian world for the most part has moved on from. Would you agree? Or?
I would agree for the most part. I think most mainstream churches, even if they're a bit homophobic and they don't believe, you know, gay people should get married, I believe that most of them, if you look at like mainstream Protestant, you know, and even Catholic, you know, sects of Christianity, that they really, they might be homophobic. A lot of them might be homophobic, but it's sort of like, well, it's a sin, but you know what I mean? As long, you know, that old kind of, you know, conservative, you don't do it around me kind of thing, you know. Don't try to convert me or something like that. They're homophobic, but if you said, do you think we should kill them? They'd be like, oh no, whatever now. Show them the love of God and all of this kind of thing. So I think that a lot of mainstream Christianity has moved on from that, you know, kill the gays on sight kind of mentality. Not the one I grew up in though. It's still very much, very much. It's not just disagreeing with that, but rather like having an incredibly violent hatred towards, you know, gays and lesbians and bi people. So
So would you say that the church you attended as a child is not representative of what most Christians believe, or it is?
I would say that it's not representative of what most mainstream Christians believe. I think talking to people who are raised in more, you know, sort of mainstream churches, or friends of mine who say grew up Lutheran, but not really, you know what I mean? Like they went to church on, you know, Christmas and Easter and, you know, got baptized and christened and confirmed and all that, but they're not really religious in a really deep kind of way, that they are, you know, would be just as baffled as someone, you know, for the way I grew up, as someone who grew up in, you know, say a secular atheist household or something like that. So, I don't think it's, some of the things they believe, that they'd be like, oh yeah, that's just Christianity, but then, you know, you take it to the extreme, like the church I was in, they'd be like, oh wow, that's kind of nuts.
This comes up, this is another common problem you find with talking about religion, is that excuse me, people get upset and they say that, well, what he's talking about, like, it's not what I believe, right? And that's the problem with religion. I mean, it's not you can't divide it to the point that there's, you know, a billion different Christianities. Each one is different for every single person that follows it. Right. But and the same thing with Islam too. It's not like there's a 1.8 billion Islams. No, there is, but there is not just one Islam. And Islam is, you know, to be honest, and Christianity is a man-made construct that is an interpretation of the holy books and the practices and the beliefs and all of this stuff. It's all man-made. It's a human process. And arriving at, you know, the truth, let's call it, you know, arriving at the truth. So everyone has their own, you know, way of looking at things. And other people will, of course, say that no, especially the more, you know, let's say modern Christians, the ones that are actually still practicing to this day, a lot of them, you know, someone like me or someone like you would, especially you would say, well, they've watered it down to the point where they're not really practicing because you grew up in a church that considered itself fundamentalist, and they're like, yeah, we're going to stick to the fundamentals. So, you know, some of the Christians in the chat are thinking like, oh no, this is not what the Christianity I know. And yes, of course it's not, because not everyone follows the same liberal sort of, or maybe not even liberal is the wrong word, but there's going to be different sects out there, and, you know, some are going to be more, and people like yourself that came out of that, I think you appreciate more let's call it the dangers of religion.
Well, I mean, like when I left the church, I think I ended up going through a phase of my life where I was really hardcore, outspoken anti-theist, you know, new atheist. My thinking is kind of like softened and kind of I feel like I've become more educated and well-rounded in my views of religion and understanding it as a social phenomena that isn't good or bad. It is, you know what I mean? And to understand, you know, it in my own personal point of view, you know, as something that can, you know, carry on cultures and traditions that are not necessarily bad. But it can also be something that holds back societies, you know, that religions have to adapt and change and liberalize, if you will, to, because if they don't, then they end up hurting a lot of people by that, you know, as societies and mores change and they have to change with them. But in the way I was raised, you know, that's a bad thing. You don't want to change because God was right then. He's right now and he'll be in the future as well. So they think, you know, the word of God is unchanging, so we must stick to it. And that's really interesting to me because on that note, what fundamentalism is like based on, this is, you know, the scripture, this is what I believe, you know what I mean? If any part of this Bible they think is wrong, then I have to throw it all out. So they don't believe, I mean, by their own admission in say cherry picking the Bible, you know, and in a weird way, they're right about that. because if you do say, well, I just want this or I want that, well, then you don't really believe in it. Like you're just, which is fine, but but you see what I'm saying? Like the people who are saying that they're fundamentalists, they believe, you know, biblical or scriptural literalists, and people who say, well, we should follow the Bible for exactly what it says. Like they have a logic to it, you know. Yeah. I want to hear your thoughts about that. Like, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a common theme that comes up when we're discussing religion. And you know, Matt Dillahunty was asked the same question, like, what do you respect the people that are reforming the religion and saying it's okay to be gay and Christian? Or do you like respect, you know, the people that say, well, no, the Bible says this, but you know, their view of Christianity is more harmful to humanity, where they're like gays being bad or whatever. And it all comes down to, you know, for me, and I get asked the same thing about reforming Islam versus, you know, Salafis were more honest. They're not more honest, but the perspective of Islam is more rigid, right? So I would say the same thing, that of course I support more liberal, unorthodox, you know, reformist, progressive versions of Islam. Of course, they're not catching because Islam is still pretty rigid and the Muslim community doesn't want any intellectuals. Anytime someone tries to be intellectual in a community, they get shot down because they go against the standard dogma that's being, you know, like, a good example is Yasir Qadhi. You know, he's an academic and he's studied Islam for over 10 years. And when he says things like the Quran's not preserved the way people think it is, like, he's like, people want to hang him. Like, it's just like, you know, there's this guy, Abu Zayd in Egypt, that he was, I don't even know what he said, something very, very mild, the Quran, something about it's a product of its time or something like that. And they kicked him out of Egypt. They said he has to divorce his wife because he's now a kafir, because he committed blasphemy. And it's like the community is not ready. And you know, it's been guided by the imams, right? The imams are the ones who are kind of holding back the community from progressing and reforming. To be honest, I mean, every academic knows that Islam, because it's a man-made interpretation, a man-made process, it can change and has to change. And people who know that are the ones like Yasir Qadhi. They're the ones who are saving Islam by moving it forward. And the ones that are holding it back are the Salafis and these people. And they don't realize, they see him as the enemy, but he's actually saving Islam by keeping it relevant. Whereas these guys were like so rigid and stuck in their ways. They're an ever increasingly small like community that's shrinking and shrinking over time because it's becoming much more difficult to hold on to something that's so weird and it's so at odds with the world, with the way science works, which is why you start to find now that some of the Salafis are also now flat earthers, because there's no way to really be, you know, be consistent with what you believe about the Quran and the things in the Quran. I mean, I'm not saying Salafis are flat earthers, but I'm starting to see more and more people where flat earthers kind of go towards that, because they're taking everything so literally that now you have to, in order to keep your worldview sane, you have to reject all of science. Because if you don't, then you start to, there's too much cognitive dissonance and the two are clashing, right? I just want to leave this comment. This is a good comment before you reply. I've read the Bible and it's a product of human authors complete with the human ignorance and cruelty. I think that says it well. I mean, the problem, I think the core problem with the Bible, with the Quran, with anything else, is when you treat it as it's some sort of thing from God and some sort of special, you're putting it a higher epistemology than everything else. So for example, if science says this, but the Bible says this, then Osama Kamla died, then, you know, you're actually taking the word of humans over the word of man. And right. and so that's a problem. But really speaking, if you treat the Bible as just another source of information, as a product of its time, and we can take the good things from it.
Sure.
Right? If it has some good things in it.
Sure. Yeah. And that's something interesting, because I think, you know, I think religion can be a force for good in certain, you know, ways. I mean, I'm not Catholic or anything, but the Catholic Charities actually have done a lot for people. It's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, like charity, non-governmental charity organization in the world. Doesn't mean I, you know, agree with the Catholics, but it does mean that if they believe that, you know, Jesus told them to, you know, give food and money to feed the poor and to clothe the poor and things like this, and they believe, if you believe in the teachings of Jesus where he said, you know, that what you've done unto the least of these, my brethren, you've done unto me, right? So when people come to you naked, cold, imprisoned, a stranger in your land, whatever, you're supposed to take care of them, give them affection and care and sympathy and compassion. These are good lessons. These are good things to teach people, to care about other people, to be empathetic, to take care of the poor and destitute in your societies, and sick, etc. But for fundamentalists, they don't really talk about that as much, because that's not central to what they believe. You know, because they think that if you save someone's soul, it's much better than saving their body. You know what I mean? So they say, oh yeah, that's nice and everything. You should be nice to people, but what's better is that you save their soul and, like, you get them to become Christian.
That I'd say that is the cause of much human atrocities in the world today. This type of thinking, this type of pointing the ideology over humans. I think not just for Christianity, for communism, for any system of belief where you're putting the belief system above human beings, because I think consequentialism, or looking at, you know, the consequences of actions, makes the most sense from a human thriving perspective, right? Because we're optimizing for something that makes sense, minimizing human suffering. Yeah. If you're optimizing for Islamic morality, or you're optimizing for dogma, then you're going to have, like, suffering in the world, because you don't care. That's not the point of it. It's not to reduce suffering. It's to please God. It's to serve this deity, right?
Well, see, here's the thing. Like, you touched on a good point there, because, like, within, you know, fundamentalist Christianity I was raised in, you know, the idea is that you teach everyone the fear of God, right? And you that it's God-centered. It's not about me. It's about God. This is very, you know, very, very important. And this is also very dangerous, because, when I speak to my mom, and she's a little out there even for the IFB side, she has her ideas about things. Before I was born, she writes a journal, and they're letters to God kind of thing, where she believes God speaks to her directly, and she speaks directly to God. And if you try to argue with her about, say, her beliefs or something like that, it's pointless. Don't try. But she, it just leaves you frustrated. But she will say, well, it's not what I believe. It's the truth. It's what God said. And therefore, if you're disagreeing with me on that, you're not disagreeing with me, you're disagreeing with God. And so this is very dangerous, because in the IFB cult, where each church is its autonomous church, they're not like the Southern Baptists that have a convention. They believe in the independence, you know, sovereignty of each separate church, even though they are linked, you know, through networks with each other, sort of informal networks with each other. They do believe in the, you know, the central. So every single pastor is basically a dictator. He's the man of God. You listen to him. And if you don't, you're not disagreeing with a man, you're disagreeing with God. And bad things happen when you have that cult of personality around these preachers. You have this system of unquestioning obedience. You have, you know, people don't think for themselves, and some horrible things have come out of the IFB movement because of that. You know, a good example of this was, there's a famous, and I grew up knowing who the pastor of that was until he died like 18 years ago or something. But he, 20 years ago maybe, but anyway, his name was Jack Hiles. He was a huge figure within the IFB movement. People almost treated him like a god, like, you know, very, very well respected. And but there was also scandals around him, that he was having affairs, that he was doing this thing. When he died, the church got taken over by his son-in-law, a guy named Jack Scott, who married Jack Hyles's daughter. So he took over. He was a pastor as well. He took over as, you know, senior pastor of First Baptist Church of Hammond, Indiana. He's now serving, I think, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's like a 13-year prison sentence or something, because he transported an underage girl across state lines for sex. So, but these kind of things, like this kind of culture, like nobody can question, you know, the kind of abuses that have happened in these churches, because each church is autonomous and they treat the pastor, you know, with this unquestioning kind of devotion and obedience, you know, to what he says.
Yeah, like that kind of goes back to the same idea of how free speech is a check on society going out of bounds. If you don't have the ability to question, then you can just go totally off, you know, off the rails in some kind of crazy direction. And if no one can really challenge that, I mean, that's the problem with dictators, is you can't challenge a dictator. Yeah. And don't you think that, I mean, as an atheist, I think this is the ultimate narcissism to say that it's not my opinion, it's God's opinion. Like God is this like super ego that people have, that they're projecting and they're saying, this is God's opinion. Like, you know what I mean? Like as if you know for sure what God's opinion is, but you think you do. So it's not, I'm not saying that. God is saying that.
I mean, I've always been fascinated by that kind of logic or that kind of way of thinking. It has to have some deep roots in human psychology, because I think like my mom's, you know, life's been impoverished and, you know, a lot of pain and stuff like that. I think that for her, God is like, if she doesn't have God, then she has nothing. She feels like that. I understand why people do it. I'm actually, I think, empathetic or compassionate towards people in this who have these, you know, kind of views, because I think they're not necessarily bad people, really. I think they're troubled people who need this kind of universal kind of thing to rest on, this rock, you know what I mean? So that they don't lose all sense of proportion for life. At least I think that's in my mom's case, that like she thinks, well, I always have God even if things are terrible, you know.
My mom said similar
problems, does it?
Like, yeah, my mom said similarly. She said that you know, I pray to God or whatever, you know, I can't, even though I don't really see the logic in that, but I mean, for her, that's what she does. I don't know how much she does that, but she is Muslim, and so she does pray to God. Mm-hmm. And so she told me, when I told her I left Islam, she was like, well, you should still have God, because you know, you can pray to God or whatever. I was like, you know, being very rational about it, I don't see the point, because God doesn't answer. But to her, she doesn't care. She still prays. I mean, I don't know if she thinks God answers or not, but because she's a smart lady, but I think she still prays to God.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, like, when I told, like, an aunt of mine that I, you know, was an atheist, that I didn't believe in God anymore, I remember her crying, like, literally crying, because she thought that I was not saved, or that I was going to hell, or that I was going to be punished by God in some way for being an apostate or a backslider. In the church I was raised in, you can't lose your religion. Once saved, always saved is the way they believe. So if they believe at one point in your life you accepted Jesus, then you're saved forever, and nothing can ever take that away. So according to my mom has told me before, she still thinks I'm saved, just that I'm a huge backslider. So that's an interesting thing within it. Like you can't lose it. No.
What if you became Muslim? What if you became Muslim?
They definitely wouldn't like that.
That's a cool belief though. I mean, it's the opposite in Islam. You leave Islam and you're killed. Right. I mean, that's the punishment, right?
Yeah. Well, when they're thinking, they're just like, well, I mean, you can leave it. You can stop serving God kind of thing, you know, but, and you're going to suffer the ill effects of God's wrath on you, but when you die, you're still going to heaven, and God is just going to really wag his finger at you when you get up there, I guess.
That's pretty funny. Someone wanted to ask a question, if you don't mind.
Oh yeah, go right ahead.
Can you ask him about what his denomination taught about other faiths, and how did you view Muslims and Jews growing up?
Sure. Great question. I think, like, talking to my mom about it, when it started with like the Christian sects, and then move on to Muslim and Jewish religions. When it comes to other Christians, they think that, for example, the Catholic Church is it's a little bit heavy language, but it's the Whore of Babylon mentioned in Revelation. They're leading people astray. It's the Church of Rome. It's the Church of Paganism, and, you know, taking over Christianity.
Are you serious?
Oh, yes. They really believe that. They hate the Catholic Church very deeply.
Wow.
Any other Christian sect. They hate Catholicism. They see it as, like I said, they call it the Whore of Babylon. if you can look up, the guy died a couple of years ago or something, but there was these tracts. We always hand out tracts in, you know, religious literature. And one of them was like these little cartoon books, very entertaining, called Chick Tracts, like C-H-I-C-K, I believe. And they're like little cartoon stories that try to teach people things like this is your life and what. And the guy who made them was a fundamentalist. And he also believed that the Mormons and the Catholics and the Masons were all together and they're evil and they're satanic. And yeah, it's really crazy stuff. So they really hate the Catholic religion. For other Protestant sects, they're a lot more welcoming. They believe that they teach that if they teach that, you know, faith is or that salvation is by faith through grace, that is, you know, you just accept Jesus and you're saved. Then they're teaching the right thing if they have, even if they have doctrinal differences. But yeah, they're against baby baptism. They say you should only be baptized when you make a, you know, logical profession of faith kind of thing. That comes from an old Anabaptist and a certain German Mennonite kind of tradition. Which is why they're called Baptists, by the way. The belief in the comes from Anabaptist, which means to be baptized again, because once they converted as an adult or above the age of reason, then they got baptized to show their belief in, you know, the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. When it comes to Islam, they see Islam as they would see any pagan or heathen. no offense. they think that I was taught that because of, you know, the symbol of the crescent moon. I was taught, for example, I heard a preacher before say that they believe that the real God of Islam, which is Allah, which is really hilarious that they don't know that just means God in Arabic. Christian Arabs, I'm sorry, Arabic speakers also use the word Allah for God because it just means God. But anyway, they think that that Allah is like a pagan moon god.
Moon god.
So they say pagans, basically. Yeah.
There's a book by a Christian preacher called Robert Mori, where he claims Allah is a moon god, and the crescent is some sort of like sign of the worship of the moon. And Shabir Ali wrote a response to that, to the book, and totally destroyed the book. The book is, I mean, it's so ridiculous. The Quran itself says, don't worship the sun and moon. The Quran says that. The Quran says, don't worship the sun and moon, but worship me. So, but there is an argument to be made about who Allah originally was, like the word, where did that word come from? Who is that God? And I think that, I don't know if these Christians are just lying or misrepresenting the truth. The truth is that Allah is similar to Zeus or Jupiter, the high God. So the ancient Arabs used to have this pantheon of gods, just like the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans, where they have lesser gods, which are more like human-like, that you can actually talk to. They're like, they can be like your friends. And then the lesser gods all report to the big daddy, the big god, right? Mm-hmm. And the big god, he's unapproachable. He's the supreme creator, blah, blah, blah. But he's not easy to talk to because he's like a king, and you don't just go up to the king and you have to talk to his whatever, right? So the ancient Arabs, they used to have, you know, the Kaaba had 360 idols in it. They used to believe that he had, you know, all of these lesser gods, Lat, and, you know, Quran actually mentions Lat, Uzza, Manat, and Quran says, oh, you shouldn't worship these gods, you should only worship Allah. And it even says, if you ask them who created the heavens and earth, they will say Allah. So they believed in Allah even before Muhammad.
Oh, right. I mean, and this is interesting because, like, I remember a parallel in the Bible, in the Ten Commandments, which everyone knows, you know, which is, you know, held as importance by both, you know, Christian and Jews, says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. And it actually says that a lot in the that kind of wording. And it begs the question, wait, what other gods? Because because the way it worded in the Bible, it sounds like there's other gods, but this one's the top god. And I haven't studied this extensively, but it wouldn't surprise me to find out that a lot of early Jews were actually polytheists. In fact, the Bible worshiping Baal and, you know, all these other gods, and God punishing them for it. But the way they speak about it is like, yeah, there are other gods, but he's the King of Kings, right? So he's the top god. I'm sorry, God. So it's kind of interesting to think about. Like, it did come from polytheism in the beginning, and it merged into, you know, like one god. If this happened as well in ancient Egypt with the worship of the sun god, one of the pharaohs tried to create a monotheistic religion around like the sun god, I believe. So it's like, yeah, it probably did start out as polytheism.
It actually, I can confirm right now, if you read Karen Armstrong's History of God, she says, mm-hmm. she says the same thing. She said that, yeah, it definitely, there's actually a video as well on my blog, mm-hmm. Where it's basically a summary, not my video, but it's a summary of the book, A History of God, because it's a really long book. Mm-hmm. And basically what you said is true, that the ancient Jews did used to believe there was other gods, and the God of war, Jehovah, mm-hmm. made a deal with them that if you worship me alone, I mean, he doesn't exist, but this is the story, right? That I will, you know, conquer your enemies and whatever, whatever. So yeah. They started worshiping this jealous God. And she talks about how it's unfortunate because the paganism or the polytheism that was there before monotheism was much more accepting of other beliefs. Whereas when monotheism sure. came, it was like, oh, smash the yeah. idols, destroy the polytheists and the pagans. Well, and it became a very...
Hmm? That's the interesting thing about monotheism, though, is that it must be universalist in a sense, right? So if you believe in different gods, if you're Shinto and you know have the household gods, like you know people do in Japan, and stuff like that, then someone else believes in a different god. Well, who cares? You know what I mean? But if there's only one god and he's the god of everything, then no, everyone has to believe like me because there's only one god that in existence.
Yeah, yeah. If he's especially. If it's like an evangelical religion and it has those attributes, because I know many Hindus believe in multiple gods, but they also believe there's one true reality, but they don't have an issue with, you know, people worshiping Jesus or whatever, because they see it as all coming back to the same source. Whereas with the Abrahamic traditions, it's very exclusivist, right? It's either this or nothing.
Right. There's not a lot of syncretism in it.
Yes.
And about the Muslims again, there's another way of looking at it in the way I was raised, and that was seeing it as, because the Quran, as we well know, mentions a lot of the stories and names that are mentioned in the Bible, in both the Jewish Bible and the Christian one as well. For example, Ishmael, you know, and Abraham and Jacob, right, and all these characters. And there are some that I was taught also from other people growing up that you know, like Arabs and, you know, the Muslim religion is a result of the sin of Ishmael, I guess it was. And, you know, like that he was, you know, blah, 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 that he tried to overtake the born son of Isaac and all that, you know. So if I remember correctly, all the names and how it worked. But yeah, so that they're the followers of, you know, his pagan gods, you know what I mean, who left the one true God for him trying to take away the birthright of Israel, kind of thing.
Interesting. Yeah. So basically what I was saying, just to finish that off, that the Allah idea is the high God of the Arabs. And when Muhammad came, basically he said, well, just get rid of everyone else. Just keep only Allah. And that's similar. Like, I think that idea of going from polytheism to monotheism is something that's occurred often in humanity. Human beings, we've done this all. We start off with many gods, and then eventually we go to one god. The Chinese as well, and they had the multiple gods as well. And, you know, some societies managed to keep that that idea of multiple gods.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's really interesting how they said, yeah. I think nowadays anyone that says that is just going to get shot down if they say that Allah is a moon god. Of course, it's so easy to debunk that. But I think there is some. Definitely Allah is a pagan god that existed before Islam. And sure. If someone's going to make an academic argument about that would be better than just saying Allah is a moon god, which is kind of silly, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of silly. But I was going to follow that up with a little talk of how they view Jews, because this is very interesting. In Christian theology, it's very interesting how they view the Jews, because obviously Christianity is an offshoot of Judaism. Originally, when it first emerged, and for probably the first, I don't know, like a couple centuries probably of his existence, it was kind of seen as a small Jewish sect, actually. And the idea that is evolved in Christianity, the underlying idea is that, you know, you had the original sin, the fall of man, right, when they disobeyed God and they were separated from God. And now you have death and pain and childbirth and all of that kind of stuff. And so they had to make atonement. The Jewish people who were the chosen of God had to make atonement to God, and to show their atonement and repentance, they would make, you know, animal sacrifices, right? You read about it a lot in the Bible that, you know, Jews had to make you know, yearly or whatever, every certain so often, I don't know, yearly like animal sacrifices to God, etc., to show their penance. But that when Jesus came, Jesus was the Lamb of God. He was God's only begotten Son, that when he, God sent him to earth to be the final sacrifice for all the sins of mankind. And that he was then sacrificed for all the sins of mankind, died, and then rose again. So the way they view Jews is that they are rejecting their own Messiah. So they see them as, you know, the Jews of the Bible, but the evil God-hating Jews, sorry, it sounds really bad, but like they believe it like that. It's kind of anti-Semitic when you think about it, it's definitely anti-Semitic. But it's but they believe that you know, Jews should be won over to Jesus and say, this is, you know, the completion of your religion. This is the completion of what you believe, that, you know, you follow the Jewish religion and practices, that's fine, but, you know, you worship God, but you don't accept his, you know, his Messiah. So that's the way they see it, that Jews need to be converted, because they need to be convinced that Jesus was their Messiah and they should accept him as their Messiah. Yeah.
I remember reading an essay on this. I can't find it right now, but I'll look it up later. Oh yeah, here we go. Michael Sherlock. I think it was by Michael Sherlock, where he basically spoke about how the Bible has been used to it's really anti-Semitic as a source of anti-Semitism, because according to some people, the Jews are the killers of God. Right, yeah. Or they're responsible for. Oh, I think actually, Bud Ehrman talked about this too. How they are somehow responsible for the death of Jesus, how they betrayed him or sent him over to the Romans, people. Well, the
way I was raised, my mom actually said she did not believe in that sort of. A lot of Protestant sects actually do believe that the Jews killed Christ, kind of thing, right? However, the way my mom explained it, she said, "Well, it was God's willing sacrifice of his Son, so that doesn't make sense. And also that the Romans did it anyway," so, which is true. this is why it was crucifixion, which is a Roman form of execution. That's not a Jewish form of execution. It was Jewish, and it was stoned there. I guess, but yeah, it was, so she didn't really believe that, but she did believe that they sort of contributed to it, I guess. Like they definitely contributed to it because they're a people in rebellion against God, I guess. So that was her thinking, but she doesn't have quite that really openly anti-Semitic of saying the Jews killed Jesus kind of thing. You know what I mean?
The interesting thing is, now I'm remembering, it was Bud Ehrman. Bud Ehrman has talked about how this narrative had changed over the time from the oldest gospel to the newest gospel, right? Like in Matthew, it actually says, "His blood be upon us, Jews and our children." It says that in Matthew 27:25 in that essay I was talking about.
Oh, right.
But Ehrman goes into it in more detail how this, I don't remember the exact thesis now, but there's a reason, there's a very important reason why the blame was shifted from the Jews to the Romans in order to prove the theology of Jesus being God. I don't remember the details now, but it's a very interesting essay he has on his blog.
Because Jesus was Jewish. So the whole theology of Christianity does not work if he's not Jewish. Because he's the lion of the tribe of Judah. If he's not Jewish, the whole thing falls apart. And then if you're saying, "Oh, well, it was the Jews who killed Jesus," then you would be like, "Well, he was Jewish." Him dying was kind of the point, right? So it doesn't really follow.
That's true, yeah. It wouldn't make sense, right?
No matter what way you look at it, to me, it doesn't follow at all. It doesn't make any freaking sense. It just doesn't. Yeah.
Yep. So going back to your story, so did we finish the walls? I don't think we did. We got through the wall, you know, how you have big families, reading the King James Version. We didn't talk about the militant right-wing politics.
Yeah, that's something that's really interesting. So they see, like the worldly, you know, outside of their religion culture as being a sign of the end times. You know, we're heading towards the apocalypse. And this is what's really interesting, because they believe they're millenarianists. Like, I don't know how you say it, but they believe in like a millennia kind of thing where you have the rapture. So Jesus is going to come back. You have the rapture, 7 years of tribulation, and things like that, where, all the saved and, you know, people are going to, you know, be sent to heaven, you know, and then 7 years of tribulation, the world's going to, you know, have the rise of the Antichrist, all this kind of thing. And then, you know, after that, Jesus comes back, and that's called the second coming of Jesus, where you have a big battle between Jesus and Satan at the Battle of Armageddon. Sound like an interesting fantasy novel, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But no, so and I mention all of that because this is really central to how they view the world. Like, say, Israel, right? The country of Israel, their views on, say, the existence of Israel, they believe that the Jews are going to try to build a second temple. And this is going to be, you know, prophesied in Revelation or whatever, where, you know, and this is what they're not supposed to do, but they're going to do it anyway, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, it's tied into their worldview, their apocalyptic worldview. They believe that we are in the last days, that Jesus is going to come back, that all the saved are going to be raptured. And so, climate change doesn't matter. We have to defeat, we should use our military in America to say defeat, you know, the Muslims over there. You know, we believe in a conservative, you know, view of society and the family. So, some of them are quite racist. Not all of them. I mean, I met people in the South at these churches who would say the most abhorrently racist things, you know, around me. Their views, like, vary, but invariably they're very right-wing politically. A lot of them are maybe interested in, like, sort of right-wing militia kind of groups in America, because they believe that America is, there's an American dominionist kind of belief in America among evangelicals and right-wing Christians, that America is like the shining beacon on a hill and God's new kind of chosen people. Funny, because I can't find any mention of America in the Bible, but they really do believe that like God was like that the founders were Christian and they were trying to create a Christian nation and this kind of thing.
But the founders were actually deist.
Most of them were deist, yes. Even George Washington, who did like attend an Anglican church, an Episcopal church, there's a lot of evidence that he wasn't really very religious and that he was more of a deist in his actual philosophy. and you know, people like Thomas Paine, who, you know, one of the big, you know, movers of the American Revolution, who wrote pamphlets like Common Sense. But people also forget that he was a huge critic of organized religion and religion in general. One of the other founders, Benjamin Franklin, called him that dirty little atheist. And he was a huge force in the American Revolution. So yeah, a lot of them were deists that had that Enlightenment, you know, kind of cult of reason kind of philosophy. So yeah, and many of them said themselves that our country is not founded on the Christian religion. After the Barbary War in the early 1800s, late 1700s, I forget, my history fails me.
Yeah.
I think it was James Madison, one of the early presidents, who wrote and said, we have nothing against the Mohammedan, you know, as he said at the time, Mohammedan religion, yeah. And our country was in no way founded on the Christian religion. He says that quite clearly. So yeah, they actually were people who believed in separation of church and state, in a secular government. That was actually very, I mean, they still use words like, alluding to God or something like that. But that's more of like poetic and, you know, high flowering language. And it was really talking about, you know, like a literal, you know, fundamentalist belief in a God or something like that. Yeah. Really strong ties to the right wing. They're anti-abortion, of course, anti-contraception, pro-military, pro kind of imperialism, if you will. They're like, yeah, go out and gotta kill the heathens kind of mentality. So it's war in the world.
It's unfortunate because then again, this is another example of how religion is messing with the world in a way that when you put dogma above like common sense, this is a cause of much of the conflict in the Middle East. Like you said, there's actually Christians that want to bring about the what they call Armageddon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the same thing with Muslims. Like apparently some ISIS members want to bring about the Day of Judgment, where there's a hadith that the black flags will come from Khorasan or Syria or whatever. So they're like, all right, we're going to have black flags. We're going to bring about the Day of Judgment. Of course, no Day of Judgment came. And of course, they got completely destroyed by the Americans and everybody else. So there's no angels fighting with them. But this is a common problem. I mean, this is a problem even with Christianity, where the prioritizing biblical ideas that are totally made up over well-being, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that apocalyptic traditions and religions are especially troublesome. One that isn't monotheistic Christianity, but is but was apocalyptic. If you remember, there was a, I think it was in 1995 or 1996, I think it was, I can't remember, but it was, there was a cult in Japan called the Aum Shinrikyo, and they combined elements of like apocalyptic Christianity with Islam, with Buddhism. It was a weird mishmash. And the leader of this massive guy named Shoko Asahara, led a cult that they believed that they had to bring about like Armageddon, so to speak. They had to bring about the apocalypse to purge the world. And they were going to do this by somehow starting a war between America and Japan, which is their allies. But he was going to bring it. And how he did this was that he sent out his followers, some of whom were really intelligent people, like world-renowned heart surgeons and stuff. That's also very fascinating, who went onto subways in Tokyo and punctured bags of sarin gas. They ended up killing, I think, around 12 people and injuring many, many, many dozens of people, some of them for life, because it's a nerve gas. It can make you go blind or be disabled for life and stuff. So hurt a lot of people. And that's the kind of thinking, like, of this apocalyptic kind of religion that can make people do just abhorrent things, you know, belief that, you know, we should, you know, invade the Middle East at every opportunity, that we need to bring about the apocalypse and this, you know, huge showdown at Armageddon, you know. And people have died like across the world because of these kind of apocalyptic beliefs, which I think is one of the most dangerous elements of, you know, of religion.
Yeah, it's definitely unfortunate. So this has been like a really good conversation. I really enjoyed this. I think we've covered a lot. Thank you for sharing your story. Now, for those of you who are here, actually, Tim has an appeal. Tim has is a journey that he's going on, and he would like our help. I'm going to share the screen. Just give me 1 second, and we can go over. I'm just going to mute my mic because my phone is thinking. So can you, I'm going to put on the screen the fundraiser for you. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's going on here?
Sure. So basically, I was living in Japan until April this year. My family's over there as well. But due to COVID, I couldn't go back. The, you know, Japanese government shut down the borders, et cetera. I've been working a bit here and stuff, but I'm not really, you know, settled here long term. So I am trying to raise money to actually go back because I kind of got stranded by the coronavirus. So I'm trying to raise enough money to sort of help me get back to Japan and sort of reunite with my daughter, who's over there. She's fine, but I'd like to reunite with her. So I can get back there and, start a new job because I was working on a contract before. So yeah, anyway, if anyone does want to, help out a little bit on that and help me sort of make that move, then I'd be eternally grateful.
Yeah, absolutely. So Tim, I do hope that the Abdullah Samir team and my subscribers will help you. Mm-hmm. If you guys have a little bit of money and you want to help Tim just to get back to Japan so he can reunite with his family and start his life over there, it would be very helpful. Yeah, I don't have to give a lot. I mean, whatever is easy for you to give, you know, $5-$10 each, a bunch of us can do that and can help him get closer to his goal to go back to Japan. This coronavirus pandemic has hit some of us harder than others. And, you know, it's a situation where some people have actually got rich because of coronavirus now, like, you know, Jeff Bezos has got like, you know, extremely rich. And some of us, unfortunately, you know, due to situations hasn't gone as well. So if you can please help Tim, I would appreciate it. And again, Tim, thank you for joining the show and for discussing your experiences. It was really great. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much as well. It was a pleasure as well. It was a really good conversation. And thank you so much for having me.
Is there anything else you wanted to share? Any last words other than before I give you the last word, just remind everyone to please thumbs up the video. If you want to listen to this again, it'll be uploaded on my podcast or whatever podcast app you use, episode number 77, Interview with Tim, and you can find it there. Or of course, it'll be on YouTube as well after the show is over, but do check out the podcast as well. So it's easy listening. You don't have to, you know, have the screen on and you can listen to it in your car when you go for the walk. It's just much easier for these long form streams. And of course, all of these, the most interesting parts, I'm going to upload to the Abdullah Samir Clips channel. So do subscribe to the Clips channel if you are not already on there. And any last final words, Tim, about religion in general, or anything else you want to add?
I would say to, you know, people who are religious, that I think that, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, atheism versus religion kind of thing, but rather reason and secularism versus, you know, extremism and, you know, blind faith, that I think that we should all use our reason. And, you know, that's why I wanted to reach out, this kind of thing, to talk about that kind of thing, because no matter different religions or sects, that what's really important is that we rely on science, reason, and respect for other people's beliefs and ways of life.
Absolutely. I think that's well said. We should respect other people, and not necessarily the beliefs, but respect other people as fellow human beings. And again, thank you, Tim, and thank you everyone for joining. And we'll see you again at the next live stream. Next one's probably going to be next Saturday. So we'll see you for episode 78 next Saturday. Bye, everyone.
All right. Bye.